This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mark Morris, was recently described in Time magazine as the most prodigiously gifted choreographer of the post-Balanchine era. New Yorker dance critic Joan Acacella recently wrote, quote, "Mark Morris was the most controversial choreographer of the 1980s. Many people loved him immediately, and many loathed him, partly because he was a young, smart aleck, but largely, I think, because his work was such a mixed business. On the one hand, he was ironic, outrageous. On the other hand, he was earnest, humanistic, and a child of the great tradition. Having seen the latter kind of work, people didn't understand how he could also do the former kind, perform in his underpants with a paper bag over his head to parlor songs. They thought he was pulling their leg. In 1991, he was no longer seen as the bad boy of modern dance. He was a master," unquote. The Mark Morris Dance Company is celebrating its 20th anniversary, and the company has started moving into its own building in Brooklyn. I asked Morris why it's so important for the company to have its own building.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I've had a company for 20 years now, and we've been rehearsing in whatever space is available. And it's very difficult to choreograph and to rehearse in a space that keeps changing. The temperature, the floor, surface, you know, is there a shower? Where is it? What are the hours? You know, really most people who have jobs go someplace to do those jobs. And for some reason, with modern dance companies, it's perceived as an enormous luxury, when in fact it's pretty much a necessity. The fact that very few people have a studio is too bad, and I'm thrilled and pleased that we have one. But as far as I'm concerned, it shouldn't be freakish. It should be regular.
Are there things that you wanted designed into this that you always wished you had in the spaces that you rented?
Well, yes, absolutely. One thing is every window in the building opens to admit air.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great. And
that's unusual. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's enough showers, you know, just sort of the mundane things. We have wonderful dressing rooms that are sort of modeled on baseball team dressing rooms for the dancers that are sort of carrels, individual sort of almost rooms. And my office is on the floor with all of the other offices, and it's designed so that the dancers arriving for work walk through a common space so everybody sees each other all the time. You know, we've always had offices somewhere in New York and then studios wherever we could find them. And we would go for weeks without the staff and the dancers seeing each other. So we've remedied that.
Now, I know you're reluctant to have people other than your own dancers perform your work. How do you choose the dancers in your company? What are some of the things you're looking for that you need for your work?
Wow, I need smart people, which is, you know, it's a pleasure to work with smart people, even though, you know, they have too many answers. I need people who can do my work in a way that makes sense, and people who can hear music in a way that's compatible with the way I choreographed music. And foremost, we have to all get along because we spend so much time in airports and hotels and theaters, and, you know, we really have to be able to get along well, dance together, be able to face each other every day, and, you know, not just imitate ourselves. You know, you want something new happening when you're working on new work.
Are there certain, like, body demands or physical demands that your choreography asks of dancers that maybe other choreographers don't?
Well, a lot of my work, I would say, because of the way I work with music, it's rhythmically very, very specific and meticulous and tricky. The virtuosity of my dancers isn't in the giant leaps and the, you know, million turns and the fireworks, basically. The virtuosity is in the subtlety and nuance and a very specific approach to rhythm and musicality. And not everybody can do that. I've auditioned many, many dancers who were wonderful, talented specimens of dancers who just couldn't get the coordination and the rhythmicity and the specific action that I need.
When you're choreographing something for the dancers in your company, mm-hmm. Do you consider it collaborative at all? Do you change things as you see their bodies move? Do they make suggestions to you or ever ask to make changes?
Well, there's very little improvisation involved in my work. People often think that to really feel free, like dancing is free or something. You know, it's like, well, it's not. You're not just making something up on the spot. I make up things from my study of the score and from just thinking. And I show things in the studio, dancers do it, they read it back to me, and I change it or make variations on it, or occasionally if it's in a tight spot, I ask how they can get out of it most gracefully or least gracefully. If I want a particular kind of a lift or some kind of a special effect looking thing, I'll ask the dancers to come up with that. But otherwise, the collaboration comes from them dancing what I've choreographed, you know, which isn't just obeying commands. It's also reasoning and logic and problem solving and artistry.
As you get older, the age gap between you and your dancers widens. How is that affecting your relationship with them?
Well, it's very interesting because, I adore them and we get along really well. I can't assume certain things that I know from sort of my cultural history. I can't assume that they know those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, can you name the Beatles? You know what I'm saying? The newest people in my company communicate in a way that I don't entirely understand because they grow up in a completely different situation. So, you know, I'm kind of, you know, they studied my work in dance history at college, you know, and that's kind of great. And a fabulous funny thing is that a couple people in my company now had first seen my work on television, like on PBS, on a great performances show, as like a 10, 11-year-old kid. It's like, I want to do that when I grow up. And voila, they grew up and this is what they're doing. So to me, that's kind of delightful and a little ironic.
As a choreographer, do you create moves for your dancers that you couldn't quite execute yourself?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know. I probably do sometimes. You know, if I see something like, oh, you can do that, that's great, do it. You know, and I don't necessarily have, you know, I haven't tried the back walkover necessarily that I want to put in a piece. But, you know, also I work with ballet companies. I do commissions for ballet companies occasionally. I just did a new piece for American Ballet Theater. And, you know, I know all of that. I work in the language of ballet when I work with them, but it's not something that I do or really ever did much. I never danced as a classical ballet dancer performing. And, you know, I love the mystery and the sort of the glamour of the way ballet technique has evolved. And so I use that because I love that they can do it. I can't, and I sort of don't even want to.
I'm wondering if you think that your strengths and limitations as a dancer have affected your style as a choreographer.
Oh, I'm sure, in some way. I mean, I have certain preferences of how to approach movement, and I've never really for quite a long time choreographed things specifically on me that I just make other people learn. You know, even when I'm choreographing a solo for myself, I work with another dancer or two so that I'm making up something that is logical as a composition and makes sense to look at instead of just to do. What it feels like isn't necessarily the same as what it looks like.
What are some of your preferences as a dancer? What feels best and feels most natural to you, and what feels really out of reach to you?
Oh, let's see. I mean, I like rhythmic trickiness and density and surprise. I like to see dancers dancing with one another instead of at one another. You know, I'm not really drawn to dance spectacle, which says, you know, I can do this and you can't. I'm more interested in, you know, sort of a, not gentler, but certainly less, exaggerated kind of performance activity. So a lot of it is my musical point of view decides what kind of dancing I want to see.
I think that earlier in your career, you became well known for doing things that were considered unusual for the time, like swapping gender roles in dance. You know, having a woman lift a man, for instance, mm-hmm. And for doing things that were seen as is almost dadaistic too strong. Too strong.
No,
a term.
That's okay.
Yeah, give me an example of what you think of as having kind of really surprised people.
Well, I think what surprised people originally and why. I early on had some sort of a reputation of being difficult or outrageous or blah, blah, blah. I think really it's because I was trying to be frank and direct and honest. And, you know, I have, you know, I'm sort of an aggressive personality, and I'm, you know, I can be kind of funny and kind of mean. And so if you answer questions in interviews honestly, sometimes you say things that people don't want to hear. You know, I came out as a queer at a time, you know, 20 years ago when it was less, maybe less comfortable for people to imagine that some dancers actually were homosexual. It was always rumored. But when you actually said you were in the newspaper, that was a little bit surprising to some. And that since, you know, lost its power because it's not such a big deal anymore. So, you know, I continue to try and tell the truth, and I don't think I really made any horrible affronts, you know. And if I did, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to hurt anybody's feelings.
So when you did come out, how was that expressed in your dancing or choreography?
Oh, it wasn't. It's just, you know, it was just a sort of an announcement, I guess. It wasn't even an announcement. I was gay. And,
ladies,
you know,
and gentlemen.
Big deal.
Attention,
yeah, right?
Ladies,
like,
and gentlemen.
Right. Fasten your seatbelts. You're all going to be so shocked at this, right? Well, you know, part of it, again, like you were talking about women and men, whatever that is, you know, their perceived historical roles in dancing. You know, part of that in the earliest days of my work was politically on purpose, you know, that I wanted everyone in the company, male or female, to be able to do the exact same tasks, you know, so that it wasn't skewed toward male or female physical capacity. Also because I don't have that many people in my company, so I wanted everybody to be able to do everything. And since having a company for all of these years, I've, you know, my politics are not shocking at all anymore. And I still feel that people should be able to do everything, but now I don't care as much, and I also really value more the way men and women differ from one another. You know, the similarities I've explored, and now the differences are interesting again.
Have any of your dancers ever challenged you about your assumptions about their bodies or gender or anything like that?
No. If anything, I do. You know, if someone's really good at dancing slow and soft, I encourage him or her to dance fast and hard. You know, I like people to have a big palette of approaches so that a great deal of variety can be accomplished by everybody.
My guest is Mark Morris. His dance company is celebrating its 20th anniversary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dancer and choreographer Mark Morris is my guest, and his company, the Mark Morris Dance Group, is celebrating their 20th anniversary year, and they're moving to a new space, their first real home in Brooklyn, New York, and there's a new book about his work called Mark Morris's L'Allegro, Il Penseroso, ed Il Moderato. You studied ballet when you were a boy. How old were you when you started?
Well, I started studying, I started dancing lessons when I was about 9 years old, and I started with Spanish dance. And I started studying ballet at, I think I was about 11.
Wait, Spanish dance, you mean like flamenco dancing?
Yes, exactly.
Flamenco dancing always has this kind of like really sexual, almost S&M kind of edge to it. What what do you do when you're nine?
Oh, imagine how fabulous it is when you're nine. You know, there are always wonderful kids who are flamenco dancers. You know, you've seen them. Haven't you? I would hope so. Anyway, it's what I wanted to do, and so I asked my mother for dancing lessons and found a wonderful teacher, Verla Flowers, in Seattle, who taught me Spanish dance, flamenco and jota and escuela bolero, and then I started learning other kinds of dancing, specifically ballet, and I started doing a lot of folk dancing around the age of 11, 12, 13.
What kind of folk dancing?
Balkan, most generally, you know, what was Yugoslav, you know, Serbian and Croatian and Macedonian and some Bulgarian dancing, Romanian, Greek, lots of stuff.
And what'd you like about that?
It's, well, you're dancing with people, holding hands or belts or whatever, and singing often at the same time. And there's a real sort of mastery that you have to get of these particular moves, which are often very tricky depending on, you know, the region and the time period. And then you have to learn it well enough to fit into a line without, you know, destroying the flow of the dancing that everybody's doing. you know, if you really, if you haven't got it, you can't break into the line and do it with everyone. So there's a great sort of community rhythm going on, and the dances aren't necessarily made for watching. They're made for dancing, for participating. And that sort of notion has fed my work since then, and I still like that. I still use a lot of circles and lines and odd rhythms and sort of a community kind of dancing.
What about holding hands?
I love it.
And what about ballet? How'd you like it as a boy?
I loved it, and I still do more and more. You know, I started when I was 11, had a lot of different teachers, and then I worked for a long time with Perry Brunson, the late Perry Brunson, who was a wonderful, tyrannical, madman ballet teacher who taught me a great deal, especially about dancing with music. And I teach ballet class to my company, basically. You know, it's a little bit modified. We do more work with our legs parallel instead of always turned out. But I teach a ballet class for my company, and most of us take a ballet class in some form, although you don't have to do my work. We use it as sort of Latin, and it's really good for symmetry and strength and, you know, practicing things.
What was it about your teacher that qualified him as a madman?
Oh, dear. Well, one thing is he vowed to die before he was 50, so he did when he was 49. He just did. He just died, that's all. He was very, very ruthless, and, you know, you would have to memorize a sequence of, you know, a 32-measure combination of steps without ever marking it, without ever trying it out or doing it with your hands or anything. He would just say what it was, and then there would be a 4-measure introduction, and then you would have to do it, and if you erred in any way, you were thrown out. You know, it was like that. He was crazy.
Thrown out for the day or thrown out for
thrown out for the class. Uh-huh. No, just for that class. And I guess it was supposed to be humiliating, but in fact, you were kind of happy when you got kicked out.
Was this an effective way to teach?
No. But the thing was, he was intuitively, brilliantly musical and could conjure in the minds of teenagers, you know, you could come up with a beautiful story that would motivate your dancing. It was partly how to remember things. You know, you would pretend and relate these things to music, and he was very, very gifted that way. And, you know, his anatomical point of view of what muscles move what limbs was very skewed, and so, it wasn't great training physically, but it was great training artistically.
Can you pass on something wonderful that he told you about music and its connection to dance, or how to think about rhythm while you're dancing?
Well, they weren't bon mot like that. It was more like, you know, you did everything like it was your last day on earth. You know, it was like everything was sort of achingly, longingly desperate, which is very easy to get from a bunch of teenage kids, you know. It's like, no, reach, your lover is over there, right? You know, it's like, oh, my God. And it works. You bring yourself to tears, and, you know, then you learn that maybe it's not just bringing yourself to tears, but maybe you should bring other people to tears or to laughter through your work instead of just making yourself feel a certain way.
Do you have any family background in music or dance?
My grandfather danced around, was sort of a tap dancer, vaudevillian amateur. My father played the piano and the organ and sang very off-key but very enthusiastically. And my mother loved specifically Spanish music, but all sorts of music. We listened to music all the time. My sister sang at one, you know, sort of how I did in choruses. And we had friends who were musicians, and we just kind of went to things, and, you know, it was a very interesting, not extravagant, but very sort of varied cultural life that we had at my house.
We talked a little bit about when you were young studying ballet, Balkan folk dancing, Spanish dance. How mm-hmm. did you gravitate to modern dance?
Well, first of all, I started making up dances because I wanted to. And my wonderful teacher, Verla Flowers, would leave a time slot in her annual recital that was dedicated to my work, whatever I wanted to do. She would let me make up a dance to put on this program that included, like, the four-year-olds doing the, you know, the marigold dance and the grown-up girls doing sleigh ride. And, you know, it was a big sort of variety show. But she would let me make up a dance, and she didn't even ask about it. I would get studio time and ask some dancers to work with me, and I would make up dances and perform them. I barely even knew what modern dance was. I still actually can't tell you what it is, except it's not necessarily ballet, but it can be. And so I started making, the first good dance I made up, as I look back, is when I was about 15. And I really hadn't studied that much. I'd had a smattering of classes in Graham technique and in Limon technique and, you know, sort of general modern dance training, but it wasn't really my mission to join a modern dance company, certainly not to form one. So I started choreographing before I actually even knew that that was what the job was called.
Mark Morris will be back in the second half of the show. His company is celebrating its 20th anniversary, and a new book celebrates his work. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with dancer and choreographer Mark Morris. New Yorker dance critic Joan Acacella wrote about him, "His work is not about some small, recently discovered postmodern department of our sensibilities. It's about human experience," unquote. The Mark Morris Dance Group has started moving into its own building, its first permanent home, in Brooklyn. The company is also celebrating its 20th anniversary. Before forming the company, Mark Morris danced with Elliot Feld, Laura Lubavitch, and Laura Dean. When you started your own company, were there things you wanted to borrow from other companies you danced in or wanted to avoid that you didn't like about those companies?
Well, it was mostly avoid. you know, and certain things, I'm trying to think of certain things that I vowed I would never do with my own company that, of course, you end up having to do because you have a company. You know, it's like, we won't do matinees and evenings on the same day. And it's like, well, gee, that's when everybody wants to see the show, you know.
Right.
And, you know, some of it is just pragmatic. You know, some stuff like we tour, we all have single rooms when we go on tour, which seems regular. But most dance companies to this day have people in double and occasionally triple rooms when they go on the road, which you would never do as a business traveler. But, you know, that's something that is a little bit more humane that I've been able to implement. Another thing is we work only and exclusively with live music. And that makes a huge difference in the quality of the work and the sort of spontaneity and aliveness of our concerts.
I think that's great. But let me ask you, what's wrong with tape?
Tape, well, it's called recording, right? It's called a record on because it's
right.
A record of a performance. And I really think, you know, unless a piece is specifically composed for tape or for, you know, whatever it is, disc now or whatever those things are called, then I think that the real reading of a piece of music involves being in the same room with the musicians, you know, the vibrations from a string quartet in person are not the exact same as they are coming out of a speaker. And also, everybody knows the feeling of singing along with your favorite record. You know, you can call a CD a record. And you know how long the pause is and what key the next thing is. And, you know, it's all automatic. And you're memorizing and committing yourself to one possible rendition of a particular piece of music. And I think music is a lot bigger than that.
What do you do for rehearsals? Do you have a rehearsal pianist, or do you have the group performing there?
I bring in the Mark Morris Philharmonic for rehearsals. I occasionally play recordings in order for the dancers to hear, voicings, or if there's a choral part, or it's like, now, you know, this, you're doing this to the oboe or something. But I work with my music director, Ethan Iverson, who's a fabulous jazz pianist, as well as my full-time music man. So I work from a score with the score in my hand and with Ethan at the piano, and I work that way, with the dancers learning the music as we go and not being particularly attached to any particular recording.
So you like to work with live music, not with recorded music. But if the tempo varies even just a little bit, does it throw the dancers off, particularly if they're, you know, they're dancing in a group and they have to be kind of synchronized in some way? You know, they have to all be working together, does anything ever go wrong if the tempo has changed just a bit?
Well, the tempo always changes just a little bit. That's what's great. You know, we're always in contact with the musicians. We can see each other. We're working together. And so everybody's kind of, you know, charged up on edge in a certain way so that we can all solve our problems at the same time. There's an old anecdote it's been attributed to many different conductors, which is, you know, asking the dancers before a show, like, how would you like the music tonight? Too fast or too slow? And that is, I understand why it's funny, but also that's the only thing that can really throw dancers off. You know, if it's really sorely out of tune, or somebody doesn't make an entrance, the big trumpet solo doesn't happen, or, you know, if it's really badly phrased, that doesn't make a big difference to the dancers. They can still pull off a good show. But if it's, like, horribly fast or slow beyond reason, then you can actually ruin the dance. And poor dancers don't have any recourse. They can't get back at the musicians in any way. The musicians win unless they sound horrible. So we're all doing it together, and we've rehearsed with live music. So it's really, you know, it's like giving a recital. You know, you're really, it's without a net, and that's what's very exciting about it.
Well, have you had many live performances where the too fast or too slow problem was real?
Sure, and then I kind of glower and maybe emphatically stamp my foot to speed it up or slow it down. It doesn't happen very often.
So where are you when you're doing that? You're not on stage.
I'm on stage, yeah.
You're
no,
on
I
stage?
Don't do anything. If I'm watching, I just have to suffer through it. But, you know, it's very rare. If I'm on stage, a couple of well-placed glances in the direction of the music can make all the difference.
My guest is dancer and choreographer Mark Morris. His company is celebrating its 20th anniversary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is dancer and choreographer Mark Morris. His dance group is celebrating its 20th anniversary. I'm wondering if you think you had a piece you did when you were starting the company, you know, early on in the company's history, mm-hmm. that you really intended to serve this function, to announce, I'm here. This is what I do. This is my personality. This is my company. And we're here.
I wonder if I did. I would say certainly the piece that is difficult to pronounce, L'Allegro, Il Penseroso ed Il Moderato, which was the first dance I did in Brussels, which was in 1988, I guess, 89. Oops, I should know. That was really, here's what's happening. And I'd had a company already for a number of years, but this was really a new situation. I had live music, a big budget, rehearsal studios. I was foreign. I was a foreigner in Brussels. And I think that was probably the piece that was most exclamatory. Like, here it is. This is what we're about.
Describe some of the exclamatory parts.
Oh, just that it's, you know, it's very, on the surface, it's very plain sort of pedestrian barefoot dancing. You know, it's there are no video monitors and no laser beams. And it's, you know, an old piece of music by Handel. And it's a very big contemporary expression of these verses of Milton's. So it's a big theater piece. And as an American, you know, I was even more American when I was in Belgium for some reason. I didn't think I was, but it didn't make me a patriot, but it made me identify more as an American than I had before. So it was really the style of dancing, the mode of presentation, the seeming simplicity of the work was adored and reviled.
Yeah, well, you were the head of the Belgian Dance Company for a while.
Well, it was my company, in fact, transplanted. So it was called the Monet Dance Group Mark Morris because we were at the Théâtre de la Monet in Brussels. But it was me and my staff and my dancers brought from the States with a few dancers I'd hired for the move.
And when you were reviled, what did they especially hate?
People didn't like that I wasn't Maurice Béjart. And actually, that's something I really like, that I'm not Maurice Béjart. It's complicated. My work seemed too plain and too something. Some people didn't like that I was American. Some people didn't like that I was queer. Some people didn't like that I wasn't something that I should have been. You know, I don't know. It doesn't take much to be controversial in a very conservative city, you know. So just my existence, and, you know, I had long hair at the time. I guess that was naughty or something. I don't know.
Did it toughen you at all, or were you just kind of blasé about it?
Well, it hurt my feelings a little bit because we got a lot of press. You know, it wasn't all a nightmare, believe me. I made up a lot of work that we still do, and it was a very, very valuable 3.5 years. But, you know, when it's not just like I didn't, you know, a critic saying, I didn't like that piece and here's why, it's like, you know, when they're writing like, you know, he's so stupid he wouldn't know how to make up a good dance no matter what. You know, it's like, well, gee. You don't have to say that because, you know, in fact, I worked very hard on it in my own simplistic way. You know, I'm sorry I'm not as bright as you are, but, you know, you can at least watch the dance.
Why did you move your company to Brussels in the first place?
We moved to Brussels because we were offered an unbelievable situation with, you know, again, live music always, a big European budget, health insurance, studios, theaters, you know, basically being employed by the government. And, you know, it was miraculous. And, you know, the arts are treated in Europe in a way that it is not found in the United States. So, you know, it was fabulous. Also, I wasn't entirely autonomous, and that's something that I do have in the United States. So it was an offer that was too good to refuse. Mr. Bejar's company had moved away suddenly, and they needed in the contract of the theater to have a dance company there. And so they hired us intact.
You know, earlier we were talking about gender and dance and the differences between male and female bodies. Mm-hmm. Have eating disorders been an issue in your company?
In my company, no. The answer is no.
And I'm sure you say that with pride.
yeah.
Do you feel like you set the tone for that?
Why? My corpulence?
No, I mean, yes, because you, no, because just in terms of what you want and what you expect of the dancers and, you know, in terms of their life and their art.
Well, part of it is, you know, there's something happened since Mr. Balanchine died. Everyone imagines that Balanchine wanted, like, the skinniest, scariest women in the world. In fact, he didn't. At the time when he was doing faster, bigger choreography, women look different in the States than they do now. So it was comparatively leaner and comparatively faster and comparatively stronger in the 40s and 50s. And I think since his death, some people have just gone mad with this and encouraging young women to really damage their careers and, in fact, their lives by starving themselves, developing amenorrhea and bulimia, and really bad self-image, bad complexions, stress fractures. It's really bad. It's a feminist issue as well. That's not what it's supposed to be. That's a big lie. Ladies who are listening to that, believe me. And one thing that happens with my company that still surprises me is we get reviews on tour that say, my dance company looks like a bunch of human beings. And it's like, wow, what did you expect? You know, what? It's not a dog act, you know. Although I love dogs, I'm not downing dogs at all. You know, they say that, you know, like the, you know, some people are big and some are little and some have big breasts or big asses and some don't and some wear glasses and some are old and young. It's like, well, as far as I see it, that seems to be what the world looks like instead of, you know, clones. I understand.
But dance companies don't always reflect the world. They reflect a perfected image of the human body.
Right. Well, that, to me, doesn't have that much to do with dancing. I'm more interested in the dancing than in the container, you know? My dancers are great. That's what they have in common. And maybe everybody forgets about the beautiful, perfect specimen dancers I have in my company, and they just talk about the freaks like me. and to me, that's so weird. It's like I use the analogy of when you go to a party, do you want everybody there to look and act just like you? You know, you would certainly not go home with a date. You would drive yourself crazy. I understand in some forms of dance that it's important to have 32 people who are almost the same height. Like the Rockettes, who are genius, and I love them, or like the corps de ballet in Swan Lake after Petit Pas or something. And that really has to do with dancing alike and hearing music alike, not necessarily being exactly the same height and weight and age. I think that's not that interesting.
When people find your body freakish, as you put it, what do you think they're reacting to?
Oh, because I'm old and I have a big ass and a big feet, and I'm kind of clumsy and incredibly delicate and graceful, and you know, I don't know.
Well, how do you feel? You use the fact that you have like large proportions, and that you think of yourself as both clumsy and graceful at the same time.
Yeah.
How do you use that?
It makes my work richer. It means I have options that I wouldn't have if I were any other way. You know, if I were 17 and hadn't a thought in my head but could do, you know, 1 million pirouettes, I would have a different kind of job than the job I have now.
One more question for you. Do you find it easier now to be emotional in your choreography and less ironic?
Well, let's see. I mean, I suppose I used to be more reactionary. You know, I was more sort of political, what I thought was being feminist or something, you know. And so I was also very heart on sleeve. I was very, very earnest. I still am. And I was ironic, I guess, because of the time and because of my personality. And I don't think that my work has gotten colder, but I think it's gotten simpler and clearer. And, you know, most artists I know intend for their work to be essentialized and to be not simplified necessarily, but clarified so that it's just what's needed and nothing really extraneous. So I think that I'm doing that. I enjoy doing that. And that's tricky because the next step is boredom.
What do you mean?
If it's so essential and so simple, pretty soon nothing is happening. You know, you might as well watch paint dry. So in staying alive with music and with dancers, you know, and especially with people who are younger coming in who've had a completely different experience in their lives, it's really, you know, I'm sort of reborn all the time just by my circumstances.
Well, Mark Morris, thank you so much and congratulations on the 20th year of your company. That's great.
Thank you.
Mark Morris, the Mark Morris Dance Company, is not only celebrating its 20th anniversary, it's moving into its new home, a new building in Brooklyn, and a new book celebrates Morris's work.